There are few forces in the world stronger than a mother protecting her baby. If you're outdoors and you happen to come across a mama bear, everyone knows you better not get between her and her cubs. Actually, it's a bad idea to be anywhere near them. If you appear as any kind of a threat, it's not going to turn out well. But I would say that's just as true for human mothers. They will do anything to make sure their baby is safe, and that includes risking their own life to save their child. Jeanette was a young mother. She and her husband, Greg, had a young baby. Their son, Alex, was just 9 months old. So Jeanette and Greg had just arrived home. Their little Alex was still in the back seat of the car, strapped into his car seat. Then it happened. Just minutes later, they were in the car while it was being driven by two armed kidnappers. She wanted desperately to protect her baby, but there was nothing she could do. Jeanette and her husband were locked in the trunk. Real people in unreal situations.
There is a girl hanging by her broken leg from the telephone wire.
And I called 911 and I said, I found a baby.
I turned around. I see a gun pointed at me close enough I could touch it.
She would hold our heads underwater all the time.
He levels the gun, pulls the trigger, and I go down.
Her eyes were full of tears. She didn't want to leave us.
My hair catches on fire.
I swear to God, this image is burned in my head for the rest of my life.
I'm Scott Johnson, and this is What Was That Like? Hey, it's Scott, and guess what? You're about to hear an ad. And that's both good and bad. It's good because ads are what make it possible for me to keep bringing you these episodes. And it's bad because, well, maybe you don't like listening to ads, and I get that. And the good news is, you don't have to. When you sign up to support the show, you get every single episode without any ads. Plus, you get all the bonus episodes. Yeah, did you know there are actually bonus episodes? And you can try it all for free just to see what it's like. If you're on an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast and at the top, click on Try Free and you're in. On Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus and try it out completely free. Once you've had the ad-free experience, you'll see why hundreds of other listeners are already doing it. But for now, here's another ad and then on with today's episode.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club. A daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Are you claustrophobic?
That's so funny you ask. I am extremely claustrophobic.
Oh, man.
So this was not a good situation for me.
That took this to a whole new level. Yeah, I can imagine. All right, well, let's set this up for us. Where were you living at the time, and who was in your family?
At the time, we were living in San Francisco, and I had just had my first baby. Prior to that, I had worked for Eastman Kodak and Helene Curtis and had about 20 years of sales and marketing under my belt. But at this point, I had my first baby, and that's what I was doing and concentrating on.
And your baby was Alex. And how old was he at the time when this happened?
Alexander was 9 months old.
Okay. And do you call him Alexander all the time, or is Alex okay?
I call him Alexander. He truly prefers Alex. Okay. So we'll just say Alex.
Okay. And this was in the fall, right? When this happened?
Yeah, this happened on a Saturday night. So not only was it the night that the time changes, but it was also Halloween weekend.
And what kind of car did you have at that time?
At that time, again, we were living in the city and my husband's job was in the city. So we only needed one car. And that's the car we had. And it was an old Lexus, one of the largest sedans that they made. So it was big enough for car seats and all the equipment it takes to have a baby and go from point A to point B.
That night, you were out with some friends. Can you just talk about what we were doing and, you know, and just take it from there, just kind of minute by minute, what happened?
Well, we had plans with friends to go to dinner, and we were going to meet them someplace, and they just absolutely insisted that we come to their house and bring the baby because they wanted to see the baby. So they live in Marin, which is just north of San Francisco. So we went to their house, had a wonderful evening, and then we're headed back into the city. As we approached our home, we pulled into the driveway and, of course, had the automatic door opener and the garage door went up. We pulled in, but before the garage door had a chance to go all the way down, two masked men with guns slipped in underneath. So they kind of rolled underneath, you know, maybe like what a dog would do.
Were they hiding somewhere on your property, do you think? Or what have you thought about that?
Yeah, my sense is that it was Halloween weekend. So they had masks on and they didn't look out of place because you could be going to a party. So they had masks on. And my sense is they were just kind of strolling around in the neighborhood and finding or trying to find someone who maybe let their guard down. And they were going to rob them and, you know, do whatever they had in mind. But it was very random. We didn't know who this was or why this was. So our sense was they were just kind of cruising the neighborhood and looking for someone to take down. And like I said, if it had been 3 seconds the other way, that garage door would have been all the way down and they would not have gotten into our garage. The next things that happened is they put guns to our head, loaded guns to our head, and ordered us to get into the trunk of our car. Of course, none of this made sense. I think they must have been in the wrong garage, but they were very insistent and shoved us into the trunk of our own car and slammed the lid. Well, during that entire time, our baby was asleep in the back seat. And they didn't even know that there was a baby involved in this whole situation. So it wasn't until they slammed the trunk and then opened the car door, they could see that obviously there was a baby. And the only thing we heard them say is, there's a baby. And they took off out of the garage. We're traveling through the streets of San Francisco at a pretty high rate of speed. And if you can imagine, when you have two adults in the trunk of a car and you're going up and down the hills of San Francisco, in many cases, you're bottoming out the car. But what we were more worried about is, where's the baby? We couldn't hear the baby. My husband was the one closest to the back seat. I was closest to the bumper. And I kept saying, can you hear anything? And we couldn't hear anything, but just the thought of two men with guns in their hands inside the passenger compartment with our baby was really much more than we could bear.
Was it completely dark in there?
It wasn't completely dark when we were traveling through the streets of San Francisco. And the reason for that is you have taillights and brake lights and all of those things. So there is a teeny bit of light that in see things, but it is pretty dark, but there was a teeny bit of light. We were praying a lot. We were trying to figure out where the baby was. And I mean, nothing made sense. I remember saying to my husband, I saw this Oprah segment and it talked about if you don't get away from your abductors in the first 5 minutes, you're dead.
Yeah, that's the rule. Never go to the second location, right?
Absolutely. But, you know, we didn't have much of a choice in the matter. And especially since our baby was there, couldn't have run because then the baby would have been left all to himself.
So you're kind of stuck in that spot. How much could you move around when you were in the trunk?
Well, it was very limited. I know my husband was feeling around because we had that a little tool kit that's in, you know, the trunk of a vehicle. And after this had happened, at some point, we decided to try to get back in the trunk together and we couldn't. So my observation on that is I think fear shrinks you because somehow we did fit into that trunk one way or the other.
Wow. You mean after the whole thing was over, you experimented with how did we fit in there?
That was years later.
Okay.
Years later. Yeah.
Okay. And was it difficult to breathe?
As I mentioned at the beginning, I am very claustrophobic. But when you fear for your life, you know, the survival instinct really kicks in. So as my husband was looking for some tools and I started to do the only thing I thought I could do was rip through the carpeting that was in the back of the car. I don't know why, but just my sense of survival kicked in. So I started pulling and pulling on all that carpeting, and it did expose some wires and things that I wasn't even sure what they were, but it did expose some wiring that I started to pull on.
Do you have phones with you at that time?
Well, this was back in 1995, and we did have a phone, but it was, you know, not one of those huge ones, but it was one that was big enough that you just left it in your car. So it was in the passenger compartment.
Not like today where you have it in your pocket. Of course, if you did, they would have probably taken it away from you anyway.
Probably.
Were you strategizing on thinking, okay, what are our options here? What was your plan then?
Well, our plan was survival, and our plan was to save our baby boy. I mean, it was sort of like, forget us. You know, this is the most precious thing in the world to us, and we have no idea where he is. We can't hear anything. Obviously, he's not crying, but that doesn't mean anything because when we pulled into the garage, he was asleep. So we're going through the streets of San Francisco, and I've done this so many times I could kind of tell just the way they turned right and left that we were headed south. For some reason, I said to my husband, I said, I wonder if they're taking us to LA or maybe to Mexico, because I could just tell that the car was headed south. So as I was exposing these wires, I could tell that we were going on the freeway. So it went from surface streets to the freeway. And again, you can tell that just by the speed and everything else. I didn't know if maybe we could get a message to the outside world that something was wrong with this vehicle. Maybe we would get pulled over, or, you know, maybe a police officer would see it and then do something about it. So I'm pulling and pulling and pulling on these wires.
That's what I'm thinking. If you pulled some of those brake lights or back or rear tail lights or whatever, then the cop might pull you over just for having a tail light out. But if there had been a way for you to open the trunk at that point, would you have done that?
I can't speculate, but maybe one of us would have and gone to get help, especially when we could tell that we were on the freeway and then you could tell we went on an exit ramp. So the car slowed down quite a bit, and that might have been a time to escape. But, you know, it was very difficult because you're torn between trying to get help and at the same time be there and protect your baby.
So they got off on an exit. It sounds like you could tell they had some kind of destination in mind.
Yes, we could tell that they were back on surface streets. We had no idea where we were, but when they left the surface streets and went on to a unpaved road, like bump, bump, bitty bump, I'm like, oh no, that's it. And I said to my husband, they're going to rape me. They're going to cut us up. We're dead. I can't believe he had the presence of mind to say this, but he was like, I don't know what's going to happen, but know that I love you. And basically, we were saying our goodbyes. Finally, they stopped the car. And I could hear another car running. And they were saying things like, get it set. Make sure you get it set right. And I had no idea what that meant, except for in my mind, I figured they had the baby and he was in the car seat and they were going to put a gun to his head and say, if you don't do this and this or this, we're going to blow your baby away. That's what my thought process was. So eventually they came over and opened, they were talking to us and then they opened the trunk lid. And again, I'm claustrophobic. I have had back surgery. So being in that position for that amount of time was extremely uncomfortable. But I poked my head up because I wanted to try to get a sense for where they had taken us. Well, as soon as I did that, I got hit in the head with the butt of a gun and shoved back down and said, don't you be looking around. They wanted cash. They wanted jewelry. They wanted ATM cards. And they kept asking us, what's the PIN number for your ATM? And the first one my husband gave wasn't right. I said, no, no, it's not that. And then they asked like five different times. And I'm thinking, boy, they are stupid. Can't they get it? But I guess maybe criminals ask several times to make sure you're not just making something up and they're getting the right one. So we did give them that.
So they probably had done this before.
I would say so. I mean, it might even have been an initiation to get in a gang or something. I don't know, but that's a guess. And then the last thing they said to us before they left was, if this isn't the right PIN number, we're going to come back and kill you. So as bad as that sounds, I found it kind of comforting because A, we had given them the right PIN number, and B, that meant they were leaving. So that was actually good news for me. We're stuck in this trunk, and there was no light source. The car was not running. We didn't know where we were, but there were no lights to be found anywhere. And of course, afterwards, we found out we were in the middle of the projects in a forest. So that's why there weren't any lights. Well, I'm focusing on this area where I had pulled all the wires. Again, this can only be defined as divine intervention because I saw this little light. And mechanically, or, you know, if you're looking at this from this standpoint of an engineer, there couldn't be a light because everything was off and there was no source. But I saw this little light and it was shining on a piece of metal. So I said to my husband, I said, I think I found the trunk release. And those words did not come from my brain, but they came from my mouth. So I took his hands like over my body and, you know, like in, I'll say in the olden days, where if you had a trunk release that was able to open your trunk remotely from the passenger compartment, that would open the trunk. And my husband knew that.
Right. Because that's a mechanical thing, right? It's a cable that goes all the way up to the driver's area and you pull a lever.
Yeah, like if you're dropping somebody off at the airport and you want them to grab their bag, you just push that button, it opens the trunk, they grab their bag, and away you go. That had existed. So I brought my husband's hands to that area, and he felt around a little bit, and he was able to find the cable that can open that trunk. And he pulled the cable, and the trunk went bink. It opened up just the way it would have if you had opened it from the passenger compartment. At that point, obviously, I pole vaulted out of the trunk of that car, went to the back seat, and there was no baby. There was no car seat. There was nothing. They had taken everything in the car.
What's going through your mind when you see that empty back seat?
Well, that was beyond the worst part of this whole situation. And again, it's so weird how your mind works during these times of stress and unbelief of what's going on. I said to my husband, they've taken the baby. They're going to sell them for $30,000. Well, where did I come up with that amount? You know, that little kid was worth $1 million at least. But that, I said that, and then it just became the mantra. We got to find the baby. We got to find the baby. We got to find the baby. So here we are in the middle of who knows where. They had taken everything. But I had hidden in the glove compartment in the owner's manual one of these little plastic pop-out keys. It's a one-use thing. And so we were able to actually start the vehicle and try to figure out where we were. I kept yelling at my husband, come on, let's go, let's go. We got to find the baby. And he was kind of like outside of the car, I guess, trying to see if somebody was still there or, you know, looking for hints and things, or, you know, maybe even the baby was out there. But I was like, come on, let's go home. You know, maybe they took the baby out. And he said, no, no, we're going to call 911. And I'm like, no, no, let's go home. We're just going to get in more trouble. But he insisted. So we were able to see the lights of San Francisco to our left. So we knew we had to head north. And I had grabbed a little piece of paper and a pencil that was in one of the side compartments of our vehicle. And I started writing down street names because I thought, we're going to get lost. I have no idea where we are. And then he insisted we call 911. And I'm like, no, don't. We're going to just get in more trouble.
I got to ask you about that. What was your reluctance on dialing 911? How would that have caused more problems?
Well, we were in the middle of the projects. I wanted to get somewhere safe. In fact, the first time he started to pull over to a payphone, like this whole gang of kids started coming to our car. And as I was insisting that we go home, and he said, no, we're going to call 911. We found another payphone. Again, it was a dicey neighborhood. And within a minute of him calling 911, a car pulled up. And there were all these grubby guys that got out. They had a poncho and, you know, really, really sketchy. And I'm like, oh, I knew it. I knew we were going to get in trouble. But they didn't hurt him. You know, they didn't go to the phone booth and do anything. And then one of them came by the car. I was absolutely terrified. I would not get out of that car. And he flashed a badge. And I wasn't even going to believe him then. But come to find out, they were undercover officers. And that area is so dangerous that four of them traveled together. And immediately, the 911 operator had sent them to us. Eventually, when they weren't hurting my husband, I decided to get really brave and put the window down a little bit. And I said, what are you doing? We got to go find the baby. And he says, I'm on with 911, and they're going to send an officer to our home. So within that time, then uniform officers showed up, and I felt just a little bit more comfortable.
I don't know how many other people do this, but I like to plan my weekly meals. Maybe I'm just weird, but I like quick and easy. That's just one of the benefits you can get with Cook Unity. Go to cookunity.com/what or enter code what before checkout to get 50% off your first week. One of the dishes I recently had was the Green Goddess Falafel Bowl. Oh, I loved it. The falafel was seasoned perfectly, and I love how crispy it is on the outside, but really moist on the inside. It's a signature dish of Enat Admoni. She's known around the world as a chef. You've probably seen her on TV. And her dishes are made right here in Florida. So I'm supporting local business, and I love that. And the convenience of Cook Unity is crazy. I mean, I've got podcast episodes to produce. I don't have time for cooking. These meals are delivered fully cooked. So when it's time to eat, I pick a meal based on my mood for that day. I heat it for a few minutes and enjoy. The menus are updated every week, so there's always something new to try. You can choose from over 350 meals based on your dietary needs or taste preferences, or go wild and have Cook Unity pick for you, because every meal is just amazing.
Make the best meal plan ever with the convenience, chef-level quality, and endless variety of Cook Unity. Go to cookunity.com/what or enter code WHAT before checkout for 50% off your first week. That's 50% off your first week by using code WHAT or going to cookunity.com/what.
I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind. But there's one show that I subscribe to, and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting, or do I wait for the next one, like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must-listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism, and he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start. Or search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking Try Free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.
Eventually, the officer got back to my husband and said, yes, they had gone to our home and they did find the baby. He was in his car seat all alone, sitting in front of our home.
So he was probably there that whole time.
He was there that whole time. And it was in the middle of the morning by then. Like the good news, because I'm always looking for the good news was that they left him in his car seat. You know, I frequently tell people that a car seat can save a child's life, even if it's not in the car. Because if they had taken him out, he was 9 months at the time, he would have just crawled into the street and that would have been the end of him. So they found the baby.
How many hours had passed from the time in the garage until the policeman found the baby?
It's just a couple of hours. I mean, it wasn't, you know, all night or anything. So once they found out about that, the officers that were with us wanted to find out if we could take them back to where this happened. And I had written down those streets, so we were able to guide them. And they got out and looked for some things. And then it became this whole situation of them trying to figure out whose jurisdiction would be involved in this, because our home was a crime scene. The place they took us was a crime scene. Our vehicle was a crime scene. You know, we just left our car sitting by that phone booth. Running. We just left it there because the officer said we had to come with them. They did bring us back to our house. And when we pulled onto our block, I mean, I couldn't believe it. There were cop cars and lights and all sorts of stuff going on. So when we pulled into the driveway, I could see in the middle of the garage, there was a light and it was shining down on an officer who was holding our baby. And our baby was playing with his little walkie-talkie thing, and he looked just fine. So that's when I lost it, and I tried to get out of the vehicle, but I was locked in. I'm like, let me out of this vehicle, or I am going to rip off this door. They go, just hold on, you know, be patient. I said, I can't be patient.
And you've already demonstrated that you can get out of a car that you're locked inside, so, right?
Absolutely, but I didn't realize, I mean, now that I think about it, right, when they take people in their car, they double lock it so they can't get out, but I had never experienced that. So finally, when I was able to get out of there, I ran into the garage, I took my baby, I went upstairs to our home, went into the rocking chair, shut the door, holding my baby, and decided I would never, ever leave him alone. I would forever stay in that room, stay in the rocking chair, and just hold him.
That was a safe place.
That was a safe place. But, you know, people had other ideas as to what we were supposed to be doing.
After this incident, it would have been easy. Like, you know, you're holding him, you're safe. It's easy to think, wow, I'm glad we're okay. Let's not let that happen again. But you took action. What you did over the next years, how did that get started? How did that seed get planted in your mind?
Well, when we were with the police officers, one of them said to me, you know, it never ends this way. And I'm like, well, what do you mean it never ends this way? She said, you don't have to have much of an imagination and look at the different things that happened to you tonight. And people usually do not walk away unharmed. And that question got stuck in my mind. How does it end? How does it end? It was like a tape playing in my head. How does it end? What did they mean? It may sound silly, but after going through the whole recovery and trying to, you know, work through PTSD, I got a fax from God. And nobody believed that I got a fax from God, but I did. And it sort of said, we spared your family, and I've also given you talents. So get out there and change things. And I know when I told my minister that I got a fax from God, she said she's had heard about different ways of people communicating with God, but never heard of anyone getting a fax. But that just was the way it was for me.
Can you elaborate on that? Do you mean, do you have a fax, a piece of paper, or this is something that you that came to your mind as a thought?
It's definitely came to my mind. I have no proof that one of those old thermal fax machines spit out something. But it was very clear to me that I needed to do something. And you know how people always say, there ought to be a law, there ought to be a law. And I'm like, this is crazy. How can someone be trapped in their own car trunk without the ability to get out? And I thought about many years ago when I was young that children would be trapped into refrigerators because they were just thrown out on the front lawn for the garbage people to pick them up. And of course, kids are curious and they see the refrigerator and they get in, but they weren't able to get out because of this latch that was on the old type of refrigerators. So many years ago, a law was passed that said, A, if you're going to leave a refrigerator out on your front lawn, you have to take the door off. And subsequently, the law said you can't manufacture refrigerators that have latches on them anymore. So nobody could ever get caught in a refrigerator. And, you know, I thought that was just like a perfect parallel to what had happened with us. So I started doing some investigation and I wanted to learn, how did it end? What were they talking about? And this is before Google, because this happened in 1995. But there were some, you know, kind of rudimentary search engines at that time. So I would put in trunk and locked in. And, you know, probably get about 10,000 matches. And you had anything to do with, you know, you're going to go to a trunk show or truncation on phone lines, all sorts of things about trunks. And I would read each one of these one by one. And then on maybe on 5,000, 1,000, I would find a case and it would tell me about what happened during a trunk entrapment. And my rule was I didn't get to count any cases where the person was already dead before they were put in the trunk, because that wouldn't help anything. So because nobody had any information and nobody had any data, I had to build a database all by myself using really rudimentary search tools. And again, I didn't know how to refine a search by at that time, but these cases were brutal, like rape and drowning or car set on fire. It was terrible. So that's when I started writing car companies and said, boy, you really need to do something about this. I was pretty naive that I thought they would actually do something about this. But, you know, they basically were non-responsive. So that's when I figure out I probably needed to look at another avenue to make this go away.
And what you were telling them they needed to do was to put that trunk release handle inside the trunk every time they make a car, right? That was your end goal?
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you build something, you can get in, you got to build it. So you should be able to get out.
What did you find on, as far as the cases? Was this a widespread thing with fatalities or how bad was it?
It was pretty bad. All sorts of things that I would never even have imagined was going on when somebody puts you in the trunk of your car, takes you to a secondary location, and has full power over you and anything they want to do with you. And I guess it became just this really convenient, and I've used this term, coffin on wheels, to take people and do really bad things to them and many times kill them. I had my piles of paper, read all the cases, and unfortunately, at that period of time, my mother was very ill. She was dying from cancer, and I was in the hospital, and the nurses said, "What are you doing?" And I explained what happened, and I was looking for this information, and one of them knew about a case where they were trying to figure it out, but it sounded like a trunk entrapment case, and they connected me with the sheriff for that area. And the sheriff for that area in Michigan happened to know his local U.S. representative, who was Bart Stupak. Well, Bart Stupak used to be a state trooper, so he was very familiar with this type of situation. So I met with him and told him, you know, we needed some help on this. And he actually was able to get some language that was passed to add trunk releases. But oh no, there was a lot of fight about that. The best he could do at the time was to get language added to a bill that said that they would study the issue of trunk entrapment. I know now it's like, no, that's not going to happen. But we pushed and pushed, and we did have a study. And it was a group of people from the car companies, from toy companies, public health, you name it. It was a very good committee. And they kind of had to invite me because I was the only one that had data. So it was put together as an expert panel on trunk entrapment. So that happened in Washington, D.C. And we went through a series of meetings. And then it was time to vote. Were we going to suggest that trunk releases get added to vehicles? And I remember one of the favorite days in my whole life is when I was telling the group about what the objections were from the auto companies. There were two. One would say, if there was a trunk release in, the criminal would become more aggressive and immobilize the person in the trunk so they couldn't get out. Either that, or they would cut off the trunk release so you couldn't get out. And that didn't make sense. Again, I had read hundreds and hundreds of these cases by then. Like I said, one of my favorite days is I said, I just can't imagine how people have this information. Like, does somebody go to jail with a clipboard and say, what would you do if there was a trunk release in a vehicle? Because none of it made sense to me. But the reason it was my favorite day is the gentleman from the FBI confirmed that what I was saying was correct and that there's no way to predict criminal behavior. So all of that was, you know, smoke and mirrors. And everybody kind of bought into it for years and years because a letter had been written to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration as early as 1979 asking for trunk releases to be put in. And at that time, the then head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Joan Claybrook, had written a letter to the car companies and trying to find out why they're not doing this. And of course, they came back with, oh, that's criminal behavior. You know, there's nothing we can do about that. But at the same time, when the head of NHTSA, that's what we call the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, writes a letter, it goes up to the highest echelons of their organization. So I have the notes from those meetings. And back in 1979, how much do you think it would have cost to add an internal trunk release to vehicles?
I don't know. It's a simple cable and a plastic handle, right? I mean, that's all that's involved, right?
Pretty much.
I mean, it shouldn't have been more than a few dollars, I would think. $5, $10?
No, it was considerably less than that. And again, this is another thing that just disappoints you to your core. But they estimated at that time to add a trunk release to all the vehicles, it would cost 3 cents per each vehicle. 3 cents?
That was the core of their objection then, right? That it would cost us money. I guess when you multiply by the number of cars, it would come up to some dollars, but 3 cents to save somebody's life.
Just so you know, that's how the auto industry works, is they would rather take a lawsuit here and a lawsuit there and settle it than prevent this from happening. And that's why it was so difficult to make change. They don't like to be told what to do. And I'm sure people weren't writing thousands of letters saying, put in a trunk release, put in a trunk release, because they didn't understand how prevalent that was. Obviously, this was something that needed to happen. We worked through the situation, and then it came to the point where we had to vote on where we're going to recommend that trunk releases be added to all vehicles. And I thought we were home. We were there. And then all of a sudden, the automaker started to turn on me, so to speak. And they said, no, I don't think we need it. We don't need it. And I just went crazy. I said, what? You agreed with this on all of our previous meetings. Now you think you're going to vote against it? And they said, well, you know, we don't see that it's needed. And this is what actually turned it over to happening, is I said, oh, that's fine. If you're not going to mandate these trunk releases, I want to let you know I'm working with many different states, and they are going to put in a regulation for trunk releases, and you can send different cars to every state in the union that have trunk releases and that don't have trunk releases. And then somebody spoke up and says, oh, yeah, she's right. you know, we're familiar with those lawsuits.
That would cost them a lot more than 3 cents.
It sure would. But it ended up, we won by one vote. And of course, that night we went out and celebrated, actually had dinner with Ralph Nader, which was very exciting for me.
Yeah, he seems like he would be at the forefront of something like this as a consumer advocate.
Well, I think he knew what we were doing in the background. But like I said, that was just a wonderful privilege, to see and meet and talk to him several times, but nothing could have been better than to celebrate with someone like that after this small little trunk release victory we had accomplished. There was a situation in 1998, and this is just about the same time as we're going to get going into this trunk entrapment expert panel. And I was 8 months pregnant. There was 3 different cases that happened in less than 30 days, and it resulted in the death of 11 children. 11 children in less than 30 days died in the trunk of a car. I don't even know how the USA Today reporter found me, because we had moved out of San Francisco. We were in a temporary home until we found our new home. But she called and wanted to know about this trunk entrapment case. And I said, well, this is what's going on with that. But what about the other 2 cases that's happened? And she goes, what are you talking about? So brought her up to speed, gave her all the information. And on Monday morning, that article hit the paper. 11 kids die within 30 days. And my phone would not stop ringing. It was within probably an hour, people were showing up at the door from NBC Nightly News. There were calls from the Today Show and CBS Morning Show and Good Morning America. I needed to get on a plane and talk about this.
Because you were now seen as the expert in this area.
Oh, I was the only one that had the data and, you know, years of knowledge, because nobody else had ever done this before. And of course, able to talk down all those other crazy excuses that the auto industry and others were making. So yeah, it became national news very quickly. And we were able to get the truth of the story out there and not all these other excuses.
So by that time, you said the auto manufacturers had agreed to do it, but they weren't mandated by law yet. Is that correct?
Well, they like I said, we won by one vote to suggest that NHTSA write the rule. And it hadn't been written by then. But I think if they weren't going to write it, with 11 children dying in 30 days, that put a tremendous amount of pressure on the agency to do something about that. And in the past, when someone else might have wanted to accomplish this, they didn't have any data. And if there's one thing I've learned in this society, is if there is no data, there is no problem. And that's what had been going on for years and years. So it really was the power of the data and being a survivor advocate that probably helped push this along much faster than other type of things we've been working to change.
So how long before it was actually required by law?
The regulation was written in 1999, and you always have to give the auto industry a couple of years to implement. So basically, it was all vehicles model year 2002 or newer had to have a glow-in-the-dark trunk release. And it doesn't matter where on earth that vehicle is made. If it's sold or leased in the United States, it had to come with an internal glow-in-the-dark trunk release installed.
Yeah, I've seen them. They are that odd shade of green that, you know, if it's dark, you're going to be able to see it.
Yeah, it's called phosphorescent.
So you got that accomplished. I mean, that's amazing that you kind of took that on as one person, but then you had the data and you had the story of being trapped, and then combined with the, I guess, the timeliness of that one 30-day period where all those children didn't survive that, you were like an unstoppable force at that point.
Oh, absolutely. When something this life-changing happens to you, you do have a choice. You know, you can curl up into a ball and never leave your house again. But I went through those different, we'll say, stages of grieving. But probably the best one ever was the angry part. And I was angry. You know, I knew my life was never going to be the same. And it did change the course of my life. But there was no way I was going to accept vehicles being made without a trunk release when it was so easy and so inexpensive and it could save so many lives. Scott, this is the absolute best part of this whole story. It just makes my heart sing. Because we continue to collect data on things like this that happen, it's not unusual for there to be a media story that says, so-and-so got thrown in the trunk of their car, and when they pulled in to get gas, they pulled that little glow-in-the-dark release and jumped out, and their life was saved. All sorts of stories like that, which makes us very happy. But the best news is we have not been able to document one fatality in the trunk of a car that has that glow-in-the-dark release. I'm talking zero, zip, zilch, nada, none. And that truly is very rewarding.
I can imagine, man, 100% effectiveness. That's so rare in any area. But in something like this, where you're talking about saving people's lives, you got to be pretty proud of yourself.
Well, I'm very happy that we were able to reach this goal and have the peace of mind that nobody else has to go through what we did, being thrown in their own trunk and assaulted and, you know, left for dead, as I said, in my coffin on wheels. You know, it's 2024. We shouldn't have these type of situations. It's so obvious what needed to be done.
You're working on some other projects. I mean, that's great. You got that accomplished. You reached your goal. But your organization, you started this nonprofit. Can you tell us about that and what other things you're working on now?
Well, after this had happened, you know, which is kind of rare, I guess, is our organization at that time was called TRUNC, T-R-U-N-C, and it stood for Trunk Releases Urgently Needed Coalition. We accomplished our mission, so I guess it was time to shut down, right? Well, that isn't what happened. Different people contacted me and said, oh, you should be working on how dangerous power windows are because they're strangling children. Or you really need to work about kids knocking cars into gear and being killed. And I was like, hey, I just sort of wanted to get in trunk releases. But of course, at the same time, I realized they all fit in the same category as trunk entrapment, meaning that these are things that happen off the public road or highway. And our government was not collecting any data about that. That's why I had to build my database about trunk entrapment. So here we go again. You know, I have this strong adage, if you know there's a problem and you don't do anything about it, you're part of the problem. And I wasn't going to be part of the problem. Build cases about people being strangled by power windows. Build cases about kids knocking cars into gear. So the new organization, Kids and Car Safety, works on what we would call non-traffic incidents. And most people don't understand. Every year we hear 40,000 people die on our roads and highways. I mean, that is such a terrible number. Over 100 people a day are dying this way. And it's just one here, one there. So I guess it doesn't quite capture people's imagination when they realize 100 people every day are being killed. But what they don't realize is to get in that database, number one, you have to be involved in a crash. Number two, that crash needs to happen on a public road or highway. And number three, you have to die within 30 days of that incident. So there's all sorts of filters before that database is compiled and finalized. Well, what about all this stuff that happens off the public road that isn't crash-related, like trunk entrapment, people being backed over in parking lots or driveways? None of that was even being looked at. So that's where we took that challenge on. And I'm happy to say we were able to get a regulation passed such that all vehicles, doesn't matter where in the world they're made, but they now come with a rear view camera as standard equipment. I mean, as I got more involved in this whole area, I'm saying, how come we've been making cars for 100 years and there's never been any standard as to what you should be able to see when you back up your car? And then as cars were getting bigger, you know, SUVs and pickup trucks, that blind zone kept growing and growing. So 15 years later, I'm happy to say through tremendous amount of fighting, we were able to get that rear visibility standard, and now everybody has a rear view camera. And you don't have to pay extra for it. It is standard equipment. The other thing we were able to do is get safer power window switches, because the old ones were like a rocker or a toggle, and a little child might be in the car and want to wave to someone, and their knee would hit that little switch, and the window would go up so quickly and with so much force, they couldn't even call out for help. So safer ones, you have to scoop up, we call it pull up and push down. So that's the way those work, as well as you now have to have your foot on the brake before you can put your car into gear. So many hard fought battles, but what these all had in common is our government was ignoring them because they didn't fit that criteria. And we had to build the database and make sure people understood how often that happened, how preventable it can be, and work to get a standard so all vehicles would have those safety features as standard equipment.
This stuff is just common sense. I mean, you'd think if the auto manufacturers wanted to make their cars as safe as they possibly could, they would have come up with this stuff on their own. But, I mean, is it accurate to say it all just comes down to cost, even if it's a tiny cost?
Usually. And, you know, not wanting to be told what to do. I mean, I can't tell you how many times people say, well, there ought to be a law. There ought to be a law. I said, yeah, let's work together. Let's do it. So that's sort of what became our specialty, is things that happen off the public road or highway. We were able to get a regulation, a law passed for a regulation to be written for rear seatbelt reminders. I mean, talk about a no-brainer. You know how you get in your car today and if you as the driver don't buckle up, you get the buzz, or your passenger, same thing. Why weren't there rear seatbelt reminders in the back seat? We tell everybody to put their kids there because that's where the safest, but we don't have the same, you know, safety equipment back there. The good news is we did get that law passed. The bad news is it still hasn't been written. The regulation is 15 years overdue. How can we let that happen? So we're fighting and fighting. It looks like that is going to happen, hopefully, before the end of the year. But 15 years of people dying who were sitting in the back seat and didn't have their seatbelts on? Do people realize that 50 to 60% of the people who die in vehicle crashes aren't belted at all? Or children aren't even in a car seat? So, you know, nobody likes that little buzz, but I do. Because as soon as someone's irritated by it, they buckle up so it'll turn off, and then we've won. And they may not realize it, but they've won too.
Isn't it amazing that they won't buckle up to save their own life or their child's life or someone in the back seat, but they will because that little beeping is annoying. Isn't it? It's a funny comment on human nature, I think.
It is. And I'm sure there's been all sorts of studies, you know, and human factors and things like that, what motivate people. But if that's all it takes to save lives, then let's do it.
What action, for somebody listening to this now, what can people do to help you or to get these things moved along more quickly?
Well, something we are working on right now and have been working on literally for over 20 years is the fact that children unknowingly get left alone in vehicles, or they enter a vehicle on their own, and that can result in a hot car death. We have been working and working to get this passed. What it's called is child present detection. We got the law passed, but the regulation hasn't been written yet. And we have documented since 1990 almost 1,100 children who have died in a hot car. How can we let that continue? If one or two children die because they've had some bad formula or even just get sick, the shelves are emptied. Same with peanut butter and romaine lettuce. I think part of it is people don't understand how this happens. They, you know, want to blame the parents, but that's not what is happening. You know, we've got a neuroscientist we work with that explains very clearly what happens in our minds, especially when we go on autopilot. So we have a link on our website where people can go and say, get this finished. Nobody wants to see children die in a hot car. Nobody.
And what is your website?
Our website is kidsandcars.org. That's kidsandcars.org.
And if someone wants to contact you to volunteer or help or with a question, how should they get in touch with you?
Oh, please go to the website for a myriad of reasons. One is you can get a hold of us, but also you can learn and educate yourself about the dangers of trunk entrapment, of power windows, of kids knocking cars into gear, backovers. And now there's frontovers. Our cars have gotten so big, you can't see for like 8 to 10 feet in front of your vehicle. And nobody knows that. Submersions is a problem that's continuing to gain. And then car thefts with children left inside. That thing has just skyrocketed. We know that car thefts have gone up. Can you imagine how that gets racketed up when there's a child alone in a vehicle and a car is stolen? So there's all sorts of information there that you can use, and that will help you protect your children, your family, and everyone you know.
And we'll have a link to that in the episode notes so people can go there and get involved. This is the thing about public pressure. That's really what brings change, right?
That's one important element. Anything from survivor advocacy, lawsuits, to data and information, to passionate parents who we work with, who are willing to be stabbed over and over again after the most horrific situation in their life, having lost a child, but do it because they don't want another family to have to go through what they went through. They are our real heroes, and we owe them all a great deal of thanks and appreciation.
You heard Jeanette mention some of the hero parents she works with to get these laws passed to keep kids safe. One of those people is Laura, who was on this podcast not long ago. Laura's life was turned upside down because of a hot car death, and she's working tirelessly with Jeanette to bring about those changes that are needed. Laura also has her own nonprofit and podcast. I'll have links to all of those in the episode notes at whatwasthatlike.com/172. And as you probably know, I'm constantly at work putting together future episodes. Whether it's new What Was That Like episodes or bonus ones, or the weekly Tuesday Question episodes with Meredith, we're having a blast with that. I've always got a pipeline of guests, people with amazing stories, who are willing to come on the podcast and talk about it. I'm never worried about running out of content, that's for sure. Graphics for this episode were created by Bob Bretz. Full episode transcription was created by James Lai. And now we're about to hear this week's listener story, because that's what we do at the end of every episode. We play a 5 to 10 minute story that was sent in by a listener. And you know what? All of the other listeners are waiting to hear your story. What are you waiting for? Just record it on your phone and email it to me, scott@whatwasthatlike.com. This week's story is from a listener who had a mishap on a mountain. Stay safe. I'll see you soon.
Hello, Scott. My name is Jasmine, and I am from Phoenix, Arizona. I was listening to episode 76 recently, and it reminded me of a time when I took a spill down a mountain. It was March 10th, 2021, I believe, and it was my 30th birthday. And so I took my two kids, one was 12, I believe, and one was 6. I took them to hike the mountain Picacho Peak with our one-year-old lab pit bull, Olive. It takes us about an hour and a half to get from our house to Picacho Peak, so we drove out there, just the kids, the dog, and myself, because my husband was working, and we start to climb Picacho Peak. The kids are loving it, the dog is loving it, but there is a woman out of the corner of my eye who is trying to approach my dog, and I tell her, you know, she's friendly, but she is shy, so please don't touch her. The woman proceeds to come closer and tries to touch the dog, Olive, and Olive freaks out and runs. I have her leash around my wrist, which now I know better, but it was around my wrist, and she just pulls me down the mountain, and we are maybe a little bit less than halfway up at this point, and she is just pulling me further and further down. I've got dirt all over me. I am scraped beyond belief. I've got cactus in me, and I can hear my kids just yelling from up higher on the mountain. I get my bearings back after what felt like forever, but I'm sure it wasn't very long at all. And I stand up, and, you know, I'm making sure the dog is okay first, of course. then I take a look at myself and I am beat up pretty bad. I'm bleeding from my knees, my elbows, my arms, my legs. And when I look back up the mountain, I see my kids and I don't see the lady who scared my dog anywhere. But in the end, I was okay, pretty beat up, like I said, but we went to the gift shop afterward and I was able to get the kids something to calm them down. And I drove the hour and a half home. And when I got home, I was able to take a closer look at myself and pull all the cactus out of me. And I had to throw away my pants because they were completely shredded. But it was still probably one of the best 30th birthdays because I have a story to tell and lots of scars still. Thanks, Scott.